Welcome to Garden Talk on WPR. Larry Mueller here, and our guest today is Mark Conlock. Mark is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and we'll talk with him about using spring bulbs in your garden. We'll also get a sneak preview at this year's holiday display at the Botanical Garden. And, of course, we'll take your gardening questions as we move along, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Mark Conlock, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, Larry, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this is time of the year when I imagine you're planting a lot of spring bulbs in the Green Bay Botanical Garden.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have 30,000 bulbs we're going to plant. About 8,000 of them were ones that we actually took out from last year's display and dried in our high tunnel. And then when the leaves dried down above ground, we brought them to our well house to initiate the flower bud within the bulb. And now we planted them out amongst our perennials to kind of live the rest of their lifetime out there in the garden. And we just started receiving our new bulbs that we bought this year that will go out in the annual beds that we still have to remove. So we kind of like, you know, pull out the annuals and then plant the bulbs behind ourselves to get ready for springtime in fall. So
yeah, you got to do it in the fall.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the kind of crazy part, right? It's everything happens now to get ready for springtime.
And when spring comes, April, May next year, you're going to have a lot of bulbs, a lot of flowers and blossoms.
Yeah, for sure. So we have like 350,000 bulbs in the ground already, plus the 30,000 we'll plant now. So a lot going on. You know, some things that we like to think about when we're laying them out is actually what I do in the springtime is I take pictures of everything to kind of see, you know, where we have the holes in the garden. And that's something a person can do in their own yard, obviously, kind of take a look and see what happens, because it's kind of hard to remember in fall when you have to buy these bulbs what happened in springtime. So I'll go back and look at my pictures and kind of send them to my email or my phone so I can kind of look and see where to, you know, what to buy for what areas. And the other thing I like to look at is like, what's happening in the spring that you don't really think about, like the color emerging perennial leaves. You know, sometimes like peonies are kind of like a darker purple color, so what, you know, bulbs will color echo or contrast with that for the short time that foliage looks different when it's coming up in the spring and those bulbs are blooming. Same with crab apples, you know, or like the leaves coming out on trees or the flowering trees and shrubs and perennials, to like use those as part of your spring bulb display and not just say, oh, it's all tulips or daffodils, but kind of like mix all of your plants together. Your perennials, trees, shrubs, and the bulbs are just like another part of your whole garden experience, if you will.
Yeah, I like that idea. And I like the idea of the photos. Taking the photos, that's so easy to do these days. And then
yeah,
you've got
sure.
a way to plan for the next year. Do you have some favorite bulb resources, places where you go to get bulbs?
Yeah, for sure. Like we kind of use this place called Color Blends a lot for our bulbs. And, you know, just homeowners can buy from them too. They have wholesale pricing and then homeowner pricing. Brent and Becky's Bulbs, which probably a lot of your listeners and know about, you know, they have like a lot of unique things. And then there's a whole lot of other sources out there, but Color Blends is one of our big sources, and they really have some good information and an easy to navigate website. But a couple of interesting things I learned, Larry, when I was buying bulbs this year, all of our suppliers kept calling me and telling me to order earlier than normal. And I was just looking an article up before I came on the show with you, because it was saying that when they planted the bulbs in fall of 2023, you know, the ones that they harvest then for this year's production, they had a lot of like high rainfall. So they had to get planted later, and then they got smaller sized bulbs, and then they had hailstorms and rainfall in like the beginning of this year. So like the changing climate affected their bulb production. So they were only able to get like 80% of what they needed and typically have. So, you know, some of our bulbs, we were able to order on time, but if you look at some of those websites, you'll see that they're sold out of a lot of things already. And then the other kind of crazy thing that I learned just this week was some of our bulbs didn't ship because of the longshoremen strike on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast. So they shipped about, you know, 3/4 of our order. But now that strike has been resolved until January, Hopefully we'll get the rest of our bulbs to plant and hopefully they'll have more in the stores for everyone else to buy.
Well, how late can you go with planting those bulbs?
That's a good question. I think you can go pretty late. Some of the horticulturalists that worked at the garden in Green Bay Botanical Garden before I started said they literally had used pickaxes in the past to break up the frozen soil. But I would say it'd be better to wait before that happens because, when we plant the bulbs, we water them so that, they start to get hydrated and it'll start to grow and they put down roots in the fall. So you really want to have time for that to happen. I'd say I'm more concerned about like how warm it's been actually, because, those bulbs like it a little cooler to grow. So, it'd be nice if the temperatures got to be a little more seasonable. But we've started planting, like we said, the reused bulbs already in the ground. And the other thing I like to think about is like, well, what's happening to all the bulbs that exist in the ground? No, they're obviously, doing okay. And they have to, be there. And you're not going to like dig up all your bulbs and wait till it's a cooler time. So obviously things in nature kind of find a way to make it through. So I would say, now is typically the time we start planting. And, when you have a huge amount of bulbs or a lot of work to do, you kind of have to start no matter what, exactly the conditions are. You'll never finish,
I was thinking about what you were talking about with the strange weather and so forth. Here in Madison, the Madison area and some parts of southern Wisconsin, the lilacs are blooming right now. Probably due to the, we had a bunch of heavy rains earlier in the spring and cooler weather and, things just got a little bit screwed up.
Yeah, I heard a little bit. They had an article or a story here on the news about the lilacs, and Doug Hartman, who works at the UW Extension here in Green Bay, Brown County, mentioned how, they kind of like the weather caused them to be off kilter and stressed, and then some flower buds have bloomed early. So, yeah, that is, a bit concerning, obviously, when things are happening not at the right time of the year. Unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do about what's happening now except for, doing things to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. But, the damage is done to an extent, unfortunately, I think, from what I've read.
Mona called. She couldn't stay with us, but is looking for early blooming bulbs that will attract hummingbirds to her garden. Any ideas on that?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't really know if your early blooming bulbs would be able to attract hummingbirds, because I don't think, they'll be migrating into our area quite at that time. But the interesting thing is like a lot of the little miscellaneous bulbs like snowdrops, pushkinia, winter aconites, those are little small bulbs that are really a cool thing to add to your garden because a lot of people don't have them. They're easy to plant because most bulbs you plant about 2 to 3 times deep as they are wide. So they're really small. So they're, you don't have to dig as big of a hole. Some people will like, lasagna garden where they put the big bulb or the tulip or daffodil and those little guys on top. But what I was getting to was that when we plant all those little ones in our orchard and stuff, we actually will see a lot of like bees using them, honeybees, but also bumblebees and like early, emerging insects and things using them. So although hummingbirds won't attract them, I would encourage her to plant those other miscellaneous bulbs and everyone to like have more early season pollinator habitat, strangely, from these bulbs. They seem to provide that.
You were talking about getting your bulbs in, and every year we have listeners who didn't get around to planting their bulbs in the fall. And if that's the case, how do you store them over winter?
Yeah, I was just looking at Melinda Meyer's book, kind of like preparing for questions people might ask. And, what she has some information in there about like having an extra refrigerator that you can use to plant the bulbs in a container and then, put them in that refrigerator over the winter. Or you can plant them in a container that you heal in like a vegetable garden. Or she even had an example of like people putting them in a pot and then putting them in a pond that they drained out for the winter and covering with leaves and things like that. So those are some options to consider. You definitely don't want to have like, food in that refrigerator that could be confused and somebody might eat your bulbs, or they can, release ethylene that can affect the flowering quality and timing of them. So I did that actually back when I went to school at River Falls. One winter, we put a bunch of bulbs in our refrigerator in the basement that we all have our the garage that we all have in Wisconsin. And, you know, they did go through their chilling period then in that refrigerator, and then you could plant those out in the ground. Or more likely what we can do is, you know, take that pot and put it in a container, and then, you know, add spring annuals to that container. So that's kind of like a way to do it, is plant them, put them in your refrigerator over the winter, take them out when your stuff starts emerging that you see in the ground, and then either plant them in the ground or, you know, kind of put that container, that pot that you put in your refrigerator, in a container and enjoy them that way instead of in the ground.
I was just thinking about my extra refrigerator, which is a beer and pop refrigerator. So there's never any food in there. It's just beer and pop. Yeah, so there'd bulbs, be room maybe. For bulbs.
Yeah, you got some room for bulbs.
Angela in Appleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Angela.
Oh, hi. My question is about planting tulips and daffodils in a bed of Pachysandra. I had to move or dig out some bulbs that I had because I had some landscaping done, and they put down river rock and stuff, so I can't replant them in the same area. But I have an established bed of Pachysandra, and I know, you know, the root system is pretty thick with Pachysandra, but it would be an ideal place to plant them. But I wonder if you thought if you thought they would grow there, if they'd, you know, find their way through the Pachysandra.
Yeah, I would definitely go for it. A lot of times it's a good idea to plant bulbs, you know, by perennials that will kind of eventually cover their drying and dying foliage, you know, like hostas or things like that, if it's a, you know, area that gets enough light. So we were actually just looking at that in our Memorial Grove garden at Green Bay Botanical Garden. We just did plant some tulips into that Pachysandra. So a couple of quick things, though, is, yeah, it'll have some competition, but it should, you know, survive for a while. And really, like daffodils and things that perennialize easily should be fine. And then the only thing to know would be, you know, you have to let the foliage dry down and die down for the bulb to produce a daughter bulb with a new flower bud. So, you know, there might be some foliage from the daffodil or tulip covering up your Pachysandra for a little bit of the beginning of the growing season, you know, and then you'll have to just like cut that back after it has 6 to 8 weeks to dry down and die down. And then your Pachysandra will kind of like take over that space. So it's a good thing to do, I think, to have ground covers mixed with bulbs like that.
Yeah, that sounds great. Angela, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk and WPR News. Great to have Mark Conlock with us today on Garden Talk. He's Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And if you have a question for him, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Quick mention, in the last half hour of the show, we'll be talking about extending the growing season with Sean Kuhn, who is a co-founder of Vitruvian Farms. It's a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm in McFarland. So we'll look forward to that at 12:30. Right now, we've zeroed in a bit on bulbs, but taking other kinds of questions as well with our guest, Mark. And Mary in Oshkosh has a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hello, Larry. How are you today?
Just great. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Yes, I went into my garden last week and I dug up all my amaryllis, naked ladies, and they were impeding on other perennials, and what looked like to be three bulbs ended up turning into about three dozen bulbs, and I'm wondering what I need to know about amaryllis and replanting them.
You want to replant them now, I'm assuming.
That's my assumption, yes.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Mark, what do you got?
Well, Mary, are the amaryllis bulbs like you have, you know, that you see around whatever Christmas and other times, or are they ones that live in the ground like Horace, kind of like the naked lady with the pink flower?
They're the naked lady.
Okay, great surprise, Lily, to be more politically correct, I guess. But Yeah, I would say that what you can do is I would just like go ahead and replant those in wherever new areas you want them to be. Because right now, when you dug them up, they were flowers, I would guess, right?
No, the flowers are dead.
Okay, the but they've already done their flowering. Yeah. Yeah, I would just, you know, you've divided them and everything. I would just replant them like you would if you bought them now from a bulb company. You know, they would ship them sometimes when they ship them this time of the year, they're like still in flower when you receive them, and you just plant them and get instant gratification, because usually your fall blooming bulb or your fall planted bulbs are spring bloomers, but those ones, you know, like you mentioned, are fall bloomers. So you can just go ahead and plant them. And now that you divide them, add them to different areas of your garden that you want to, I would give them a good drink of water to, like, you know, resettle any air pockets and, you know, make sure that they have, you know, taken moisture and start growing slightly. And then, like, you know, they'll have their foliage in the springtime, and then that'll die back down, and then you'll get your flowers in the fall, and you'll probably have even more blooms because now you've separated them, and they'll be able to mine the soil for more nutrients and, you know, water all around where you put them now.
That makes a lot of sense. Mary, thank you very much for calling. I'm wondering about fertilizing. What are your thoughts about adding fertilizer when you're planting bulbs?
You know what, Larry, you must have read my mind, because I was just thinking about that with Mary's question, you know, if like, usually that's, and I also read an article recently about someone from Holland, Michigan, that's a big grower of like millions and millions of bulbs. And the advice in that article was like pretty much the opposite of what I do. So I was a little concerned about that, obviously. But what I know from my, you know, River Falls, what I learned in color blends things are that when you plant your fall blooming bulbs, you don't need to do anything to them. You don't need to fertilize, because if you dissect one, which is kind of a cool project to try out, you'll see inside there a baby flower and baby leaves, and then it uses the scales, you know, of the bulb, either leaf tissue or a corm, which is stem tissue, and that energy is there to like go into the bulb to make it grow the leaves and the flower in the springtime. So you really don't need to fertilize when you plant your bulbs, because everything is in there. Plus in the fall, it's just putting its roots down. So it's not, you know, like growing into the leaf tissue. So we don't fertilize our bulbs at all at Green Bay Botanical Garden. And then, you know, in the springtime, it'll grow, like I said. And then that would be the time, if you needed to fertilize or wanted to, you would do it kind of like after the bulb is flowered, so that when it's translocating all that energy down in the leaf is kind of dying back. I call it drying and dying. And it's like translocating all the energy carbohydrates back to the basal plate where it has the axillary buds where the new bulbs form. You know, that's when you can do that. Again, we really don't fertilize our bulbs ever. But if you really wanted to, you could, to like, you know, try to get them to have be potentially more floriferous, or to have more daughter bulbs that would then you could divide, you know, and transplant. So that's my advice. You know, and again, like at first when you plant them, you don't need to fertilize, and you could do it. But when you do it, you would do it in the springtime, actually.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for that question. Pamela in Wausau, what's on your mind?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I've been an avid gardener for a long time, and I was blessed with a greenhouse recently. So this is a wood and window construction, and it is outfitted for LP and for electric. It has fans. So I am beyond excited to start this, and I'm just not sure where to start. So, yeah, I'm excited, but I don't know what to do.
How big is it, by the way?
It's about 9 feet wide, about 13 feet long,
okay.
9 foot ceilings. It has full shelf along the length of it, and then other shelves in the back. So there's lots of wonderful space. And I plan on adding a bar on the back of it to hang hanging plants. But I'm thinking of starting with head lettuce for the winter, but I'm not sure if that's too big of an undertaking and if I should just wait and do more flowers. I do want to do vegetables in it, but my main goal is beauty, not food. But just wondering, like, for the winter, if head lettuce would be a good thing to start or not so much.
Oh, well, that's a good question, and definitely maybe a question for 12:30. But I'll just tell you what I know about a couple of those things from our greenhouses that we have at the Botanical Garden and the High Tunnel, and some of the, or NWTC, Northeast Wisconsin Technical College, has an organic egg program where they have some cold frames where they grow some things into. So I guess a couple ideas I have are, you know, think about your cost potentially of your, you know, gas and everything to run that versus the cost of what you're growing, you know, and like if it's going to be economical that way for the headless or smaller crops. And I think that next person on the show would have some good ideas about that, it sounds like. But from our production of our annual plants, what you probably are going to want to do is see if there's a spot, like, you know, in your home even that you've already used to start seedlings early, you know, under grow lights or something like that, and, you know, have them in a smaller spaced, you know, container, like a four pack, or we use these things called 288 plug trays, so that we, you know, have less, the plants are taking up less space at first, because, you know, it costs money to heat space. So they'll start in a smaller area where it's less expensive. And then as they get bigger with more true leaves on them, we'll transplant them up to the next size and start to expand our space requirements. So usually, you know, also look at the guidelines on the seed packet, or Ball Horticulture has a culture guide of telling you, like, you know, when to start your crop. So you should probably think about all the crops you want to grow, what you want to have as your finish date for the crops that you start hardening them off and taking them out of that greenhouse, and then work backward on a, making a production schedule, so you know when to sow the crops and when to transplant them. And then you'll be able to, like, get an idea of, like, when you need the most space of your greenhouse. And the other idea is you might want to, like, depending on where the heater is and the ventilation, get a big piece of, like, clear plastic where you could sheet off potentially part of it. So you're only heating, you know, half of it at first as you're starting to use the space. And then that would save you, you know, some costs on your gas and, you know, your heating costs. So I think it's a very exciting project. I think if you, like, look at what you want to grow and the timing of it, that'll help, you know when you need to open it. And if you have other space you can grow some of the seedlings in your house that might be more cost effective, that would help you make the best use of the structure.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as I was thinking about it with Pam, there are a lot of vegetables, actually. I mean, we're talking flowers mostly today, but there are very colorful vegetables and cabbages and everything. You can get varieties now that add a whole lot of color to the garden. And I'm thinking that you guys do a little of that, don't you, at Green Bay?
Yeah, that's another good point, you know, Larry, is that you could look at some of the cool season crops like the lettuces, you know, kales, pansies, alyssums, and things, you know, and with the opportunity of having a greenhouse, you could, like, you know, have a couple different crops scheduled and cycle through that greenhouse, you know, for your home yard production. So that's kind of what we do too, is, like, honestly, there's a ginormous production schedule we have that's like over, you know, 500, 600 lines on an Excel spreadsheet that times out all of our crops, because we grow about 25,000 plants from seed in our organization. And then we, you know, buy all those seeds and plugs and things. So we have some experience, but yeah, the first thing that we typically seed are those, like, cool season crops. And that would allow her to have the greenhouse set at a lower temperature too.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You must have a large number of volunteer groups or people helping you out every week at the garden.
Yeah, we definitely do. We have, we have our horticulture staff, of course, and our seasonal employees and interns. And then we have, like, core groups of volunteers that come out Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and help us. And then with the whole big bulb planting operation, we kind of recruit a lot of, like, corporations in the area that come out and help us with the bulb planting. And it's a good, like, team building exercise for everyone to kind of, like, work together on a big project and be outside in the beautiful sunshine that we've had. Sometimes it's not as nice as it has been this year, but huge amount of volunteers that are, you know, helpful to make this all happen at Green Bay Botanical Garden.
Dave in Appleton called but couldn't stay with us. Flower seeds are on sale right now. Would it be okay to buy them now, plant them, to have them bloom in the spring? Dave is especially interested in dahlias. Do you know if deer like dahlias?
Well, a couple of points there. I mean, if you're, you know, looking at seed, you could probably buy it, but I would refrigerate it, you know, until you're going to start it based on the seed pack date, which like will be a while. So, I mean, unless you really want to save some money, which probably isn't that significant, you can wait till probably springtime when they have them for sale as well. But if you did buy seed now, I would refrigerate it to preserve it to be able to start in springtime to then grow. Dahlias, I haven't noticed deer like eating a lot of our dahlias, honestly. A lot of times, you know, they're a tuber that's overwintered or a tuber you buy in the springtime and then, you know, plant then in the summer, or you can overwinter those to save money. And there is also a lot of seed grown dahlias. And we've been doing, like, we trial for All America Selections, and the last 2 years they've had kind of like dark leaved dahlias grown from seed that have sized up, and both of them, in our opinion, have been winners. So that's something to look for, like on All America Selections website. There's some really nice seed grown dahlias that you could buy the seed for, you know, like in late winter, early spring, and start from seed and get a really sizable plant early in the summertime and not have to worry about like all that tuber overwintering type thing.
That's pretty cool. Did you have, just speaking or thinking about the All American Selections and so forth, were there some plants this year, flowers this year that you, that really caught your eye, something new a little bit that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, well, we do the, we do the ornamentals from seed testing. So there was a kind of a really nice spreading pink petunia that had like darker venation in the middle of the flower that I thought was really nice. And kind of an interesting thing that was there were like some different petunia series that were kind of like seed grown that had characteristics of just, you know, vegetatively produced petunia. So that was just like an interesting trend to see in the breeding industry where they're trying to probably bring the cost down for, you know, us home gardeners. That dahlia for sure, you know, stands out as like a really awesome plant that we thought was a winner. And some of the previous winners, if you see, there's this red yellow bicolor profusion zinnia that it was a gold medal winner, and it starts out yellow and red, and then it kind of ages to salmon colors on it and apricot color flowers, and they're all on there at the same time. So that one in the fall especially stands out as a really nice plant to add to your garden design. So that's one I would look at, but I'd definitely check out their website because, you know, they have all that information on there, pretty easy to find the AAS winners, and you can pick whatever, you know, your heart desires versus my heart.
what was the name of that last plant you mentioned that you like so well? That turns to salmon.
Red, yellow, bicolor. I think it's Profusion Series Zinnia.
Okay, Profusion Series Zinnia. A listener emailed us, what about the big red amaryllis bulbs? They let the leaves dry in their potted plants and cut them down. Is it best to take the bulbs out of soil and leave to rest bare to dry root, or repot them now? What's the best way?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's something I was looking at before I came on the show, actually, too. And I have experience with it because I have quite a few amaryllis that I overwinter. So what I've found to be the most successful is probably similar to what it sounds like they're doing right now. It's like I bring those pots in and I let the, you know, foliage dry back and die down. And then what's been more successful for me is I just take that whole pot and I put it in like a dark closet. I put it in my walk-in closet where all my work clothes are, actually. And then, you know, I give it that dark period that it needs, like 8 to 12 weeks. Usually the other quick thing that I do that is I mark on my calendar when I'm supposed to take it out of there. Because otherwise, like, I forget when to do it. but I have also, removed all the soil from the bulb and just, like, you know, put the soil in a bag in the closet. And I haven't been as successful doing that method. But you could do that. That is a way you can do it to save space. But the most successful thing for me has been where I let it dry down and then I put it in the closet for the, you know, dark requirement it needs. And then I bring it out like based on my calendar and then I start watering it and I try to put it in like a place in my apartment that has light so that it, you know, starts to get, you know, light onto it. And then the leaves will emerge first, typically at when you kind of like, you know, make them come through the winter like that. And then you'll get a bigger flower bud that comes up if you're lucky.
And right along with that, Brenda emailed us. She's wondering about storing her amaryllis, which is planted in a 2-quart planter. It's presently outside. Brenda would like to continue with it being outside for the next season in that container. This was the seasonal kind of bulb gifted to them in like January. It's blossomed twice this season outdoors.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I mean, if that 2-quart container doesn't sound too giant to me, you know, if possible, what I would do would just be like, you know, bring that inside probably close to this time of the year now before it gets too cold and let it do its thing drying down. Don't water it anymore, you know, let it go dormant in essence. And then once it all the leaves are down, you know, bring it into a dark location for whatever 8 to 12 weeks is what I believe it says on the information. You can Google it, of course, and find it out. The quick thing is, I usually, when I Google things, I'll do like my question of like how to overwinter an amaryllis, but then I'll add UW extension into it.
Yeah.
So I get, you know, a really good, you know, science-based answer from the great UW extension system in Wisconsin. And like I said, mark that on your calendar, and then you just have to take it out and start watering it and put it in some light, and you could leave it right in that container, and that's nice and easy to do.
Mike emailed us, how do you overwinter begonias?
Well, we don't really overwinter them very much at the Botanical Garden, but I was looking at Melinda Meyer's book, and I know she was on your show a little bit ago, and, you know, she says in there, you know, that one way you can do it is you can just actually pot them up and grow them on as like a house plant in your house, you know, if it has enough light. There are kind of like tuberous begonias where you could, you know, save that tuber part, you know, in the right storage requirements. If you look at Melinda's website, she has information on like the exact storage, but the gist of it is it's like a cool, dark place that's usually, you know, not as warm as you keep the top part of your house. So maybe, you know, a basement or an insulated garage or something like that. Usually the temperature is around, you know, 55 to 65 degrees. And then you would just repot it up in the springtime and then start growing it again. So, or you can, you know, the other kind of crazy thing is the begonias, there's a lot of them that you can grow from seed, actually. The seeds are really small, but we grow some of the most, you know, the biggest ones like big begonia, whopper, megawatt from little seeds, but we have to start them in February, you know, to get them to size up enough. But that's like another interesting thing to look into is like, some of those ones you can grow like that. Those aren't tuberous begonias, but you can also grow tuberous begonias from seed as well. You can definitely try overwintering them, but just so you know, if it doesn't work, there's other options, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, growing from seed, that's can save a fair amount of money if you've got the right conditions, you know, for the seeds.
Yeah, for sure. And then it allows you to kind of like pick whatever you want versus having to buy just what's for sale in your local area or wherever you go to.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Mark Conlock, our guest today, he is director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. We're talking what's going on at the gardens. We're talking flowers and bulbs, and I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us for Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Conlock. Mark is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Next week, by the way, on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston are back to talk about what went on in the gardening over the course of the year. We'll look at disease and other questions as well. And the last half hour, we'll talk about caring for ferns. But right now, we're looking at flowers and bulbs, and taking your questions again, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. What about, do you guys do a lot of naturalizing, bulb naturalizing?
Yeah, that, you know what, I have a little sheet of things I wanted to mention, and that is one of the things we've really been doing a lot of is we've transitioned some areas from turf grass to meadow plantings of kind of like sedge and different no-mow grass mixes and things with some perennials thrown in there for color. And in those areas, what we do is we plant a lot of the smaller miscellaneous bulbs or kind of like smaller dwarf cultivars of daffodils and some species tulips and things like that. That color blends place actually has a like a whole group of pre-made mixes called Color Your Grass that we either buy or we use them as inspiration. And then, you know, that what's nice about those is you don't like usually we measure our bulbs all with a bamboo stick because, you know, we buy it based on a square footage of space. So we need to make sure we space them the right way. But with those like ones you plant in your turf grass or like a meadow, you can just like throw them and sprinkle them on the ground to look more natural. And then, you know, a lot of times, like I said before, they're smaller bulbs so that you don't have to dig as big of a hole. And then they're beautiful. And the thing to know, though, is that you have to, you know, like let that foliage die down and dry down again to like produce the next bulb before you would do any mowing of it. You know, we don't even mow those meadow type plantings in the no-mow grass. We actually just let it seed out this year and kind of like celebrate the seed heads of that and how it looks all tawny and kind of like, you know, it's got its own beauty, I would say.
Yeah.
And then in the sedge meadow areas, what's awesome is that those sedges are, you know, pretty, you know, they establish pretty fast from a plug, and then they'll just cover that drying foliage. So we don't even need to do any work like cutting it back because it gets, you know, obscured as that perennial sedge grows and covers it up. And it's about the right time, you know, for it to have enough time to get the light it needs to reproduce the bulb, but then it gets covered up the foliage by the sedge and we don't even need to do any work. So definitely recommend that to people. And, you know, Larry, the other kind of crazy thing I was going to mention to you is like, I've done some like guerrilla gardening where I'll take like the little miscellaneous metal bulbs like that. And I put them like at the cemetery where my grandparents are. So like, instead of, you know, having a bouquet at their gravesite, I have like the little bulbs blooming all around there. So that's kind of like an interesting little thing you could do there, or you can do that in your own, you know, yard at your house, plant those miscellaneous, you know, small bulbs like snowdrops and things in your turf grass. You just have to like let your grass grow a little bit more before you mow it.
I should probably let it grow a little bit more anyway. Why not? So, well, you kind of mentioned cleanup a little bit, or having to not do much cleanup. I, to be honest, there's some areas where I never do any. I just let it go because many of those plants, is, I think it's just as well not to blue stems and those to cut them back anyway.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. We've really switched the way we think about our, you know, garden cleanup in the fall over the last years. Some of it was reading the information from like Doug Tallamy and his, you know, books about how insects actually overwinter on in those stems and on the leaves and things that you're typically thinking about raking up and getting rid of there. So a lot of areas now we try not to rake the leaves even out of where we used to in the past. And our cutback, we do have to cut back because of our bulb display, but there are areas like where we have all those native plants in there that we let up all, you know, fall. And then we, a lot of times they'll kind of just like, you know, go down on their own over time. Or the other kind of interesting thing we've been doing that people could do if they really want to do some cutting back is we'll kind of like cut it back in pieces and just let those smaller pieces filter down to the ground and be mulch. And then we try to, like, instead of our last cut being, say, 2 or 3 inches above the ground, we switch to making it be, like, you know, a foot or a little bit more, because that's where, according to some of, you know, Doug's information, is where the insects overwinter in the bottom foot of the stem. So I'm not sure if, you know, that opens it up to cold and makes it so they can't overwinter. But instead of, like, you know, cutting that part off, we'll leave that part open. The other thing we've done that's a little bit different than a person may be able to do is like when we've cut stuff back where we do have the bulbs and we do have to cut it low, we kind of like, instead of making a giant compost pile, we kind of like will line the edge of a woods with like just a, you know, one load of that debris to kind of spread it out over a longer area to like not suffocate everything that's in there. I'm not sure if that's an actual scientific based thing, but that's just something I thought if I was an insect, I would prefer so that I could still get out of there.
Mark Gunlock, our guest, you know, this time of the year, when a lot of people, a lot of my neighbors are doing pretty extensive cleanup, and I'm not doing any, but it seems like the lazy way to do it. But I read some of Doug's work too, Tallamy's work as well, and I thought, I don't have to do the work, and I kind of like the way it looks, even though, you know, there aren't a bunch of flowers in there right now. There's some, but not much. But how do you keep you've got a fine balance there a little bit at the gardens, because I've never been there when the gardens didn't look good. I mean, it always looks good.
Well, thank you, sir. Yeah, I say it's always a good day to visit Green Bay Botanical Garden. You know, the quick thing, like what you're saying is, like, I call it celebrating senescence, or celebrating, you know, like as the plants kind of go down in the fall. So that's like it's kind of like a change of mindset, right, for people, because we feel like we have to clean all this stuff up, but we really don't have to do it. So it's also like doing more by doing less. You know, from an ecological standpoint, and thinking about your garden is, you know, more than just the pretty flowers for you, but for the, you know, the habitat value of it. And I think as people start to learn more about that, they'll probably transition more to like your methodologies of not doing as much, because it's actually better for the environment and the habitat. And it probably is better for your garden, because you'll have more of those beneficial insects, you know, overwintering and being there for the next season. We have to think about the cutback for like certain things, like our light show exhibits and for the spring blooming bulbs. But like we said previously, we kind of have really transitioned to like a lot of doing less as well, so that we have a better habitat, because we're really trying to follow Doug's information and, you know, really be more than just the pretty garden. And kind of like another crazy thing, Larry, I was going to tell you is we've been working on like growing off of our site at Green Bay Botanical Garden, because we have developed a lot of our land and we only have a little bit left of acreage to develop, and some is delineated wetland. So we've done some futuring work at the botanical garden where we've, you know, decided to like bring the garden out into the community. And the big part of that so far has been this pollinator corridor that we've been working on with the Conservation Corps of the City of Green Bay, where we've started to like work with them on some of their parks to do some of those native plantings that we started to learn a lot about. And we grow a lot of the seedlings in our greenhouse, and then we donate the plants and our time to help that group, who then take care of the areas. They like get it watered the first year, and then they, you know, their mandate is to like maintain all the natural areas in the parks of the City of Green Bay. So we love that partnership, because we know that even native plants require work, you know, to make sure that they don't get overtaken by, you know, other things and weeds and, you know, invasive species and things. So that's really been a pretty cool partnership. And we've worked with the Xerces Society in Madison, MICA, to get information on the plants we should grow. And, you know, we did two parks this year, and we're going to do three parks in the City of Green Bay and a park in the village of Hobart this upcoming year. Wow. So we're really trying to expand that program.
That's a great program. John in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi. Hey, I've been planting and pulling up in the fall canna bulbs, and they've turned out beautifully. I don't know, is there anything else? Can I cut them back now? I mean, there's still a little bit of blooming on them. And do I have to dig them up every fall?
Yeah, those are good questions for sure. You could cut them back. I'd say now, you know, what we're doing right now at the garden with our cannas that we overwinter is we dig them out of the ground, you know, starting now, because we're planting all those other, you know, spring blooming bulbs. And then we throw them like on a tarp in our high tunnel to let them, you know, cure for a short amount of time. I don't think it has to be very long. Again, Melinda Myers has some information about like, you know, the amount of timing. And then we'll cut the stem off, you know, a little bit above the tuber, and we'll knock the soil off. We usually don't, you know, you don't really need to clean them off, or you probably know your own methodology too, but the gist of it is, yeah, you could dig them out anytime now, because it will have those tubers down there. But the other thing I wanted to mention to you is they have been working on like seed grown cannas. So like Ball Horticulture Company, if you go to their website, they have the Canova series, And then there's been some AAS winners too that are, you know, more like purple leaved winners. So what's kind of crazy is like, you don't have to necessarily do all the tuber overwintering, but then you would have to obviously have the way to grow them from seed yourself too. So, I mean, it's probably easier for most people to just overwinter the tuber. But the thing is that the price of them will probably have come down because they can be seed grown instead of, you know, tuber grown.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. There you go, John. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. How do you protect the plants and trees, you know, from winter damage and so forth in at the garden? And how can we do it in the home garden?
Yeah, good question, Larry. Well, one of the things to think about, I'd say this year with how dry it's been, is to make sure you give all your plants, especially plants that you put in this year, you know, a good thorough deep watering before you, you know, turn your water off and put your hose away. And I think, you know, the thing to consider to do would be, you know, after you're doing that, to mulch your soil if possible around, like, especially trees and shrubs and like things that you spent a decent amount of money on to help them get through the winter, and conifers especially too. And then what we do for some of our plants is some of them we do protect with like hardware cloth, you know, to keep small voles and rabbits and critters from, you know, eating on them, especially tree peonies, which are fairly expensive plants, some of the most expensive plants we have.
Yeah.
And we don't want a rabbit to eat on those, which they have in the past. And then, you know, the other thing we've had to do at the garden is put burlap on almost all of our, you know, Thuja occidentalis arborvitas because of the deer population that, you know, unfortunately has, you know, kind of started to live in our grounds. And probably because of all the nice habitat we've created for them. Mm. You know, so we start to wrap those conifers, and, you know, not quite yet, but we'll plant all our bulbs. We'll do a lot of our cutting back that we have to do. And then we start putting the cages out on like the high value plants and some thinner bark plants like moose bark maples and things like that. And like our Japanese maples that we have that are, you know, pretty expensive plants and hard to grow in our climate. And then we'll put the burlap on all of those, you know, trees, all those arborvitas especially, and also use, you know, the deer particularly love those. So we kind of have to now cover all those up. I mean, that's become a big job. I mean, it almost takes us a week probably to burlap everything with all of our staff. So that's been a bit of a tedious new job to have to do.
Yeah. When do you do that? I mean, what time of the November or when?
Yeah, typically it's, you know, pretty much the beginning of November is when we'll start to do it. You know, the other thing, Larry, that we do that some people may already do is our rose is we overwinter. Usually those we do around Thanksgiving is typically when it happens to be. But, you know, the shrub roses don't really require any protection in our climate. But we have hybrid teas, floribundas, grandifloras, David Austin, like English roses. Those English roses might be okay, but we usually... We try to wait for the ground to freeze so that we're not like mulching in warmth. And then we will like put about 2 to 3 feet of mulch amongst the canes after the ground freezes, which is typically around Thanksgiving for us and before our big light show event. And then we will put like some rodent bait in there because in the past we've had voles get in there and like, yeah, you know, girdle every single cane. And sometimes they will die down pretty far still, but the crown and the roots in, you know, where it's grafted to will be alive. So we have been able to overwinter a lot of our roses for many, many, many years and have some really substantial specimens of hybrid teas and grandiflora and floribunda roses. And that's how we do it, by mulching them pretty much once the ground freezes.
Yeah, very cool. Mark Conlock, our guest, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We got Jan and LaCrosse waiting to ask a question. Jan, hang in there. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Conlock. Mark is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. It's great to have him back with us. We've been talking a lot about bulbs and flowering plants. And certainly, if you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share, give us a call. Number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Jan in La Crosse, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Happy to wait. Love your show. I missed you when you were here in La Crosse a couple weeks ago. Tried to get tickets, but they were sold out. I actually have two questions. The first one is my irises have quadrupled, and I need to break them up, and I'm just wondering, is it better to do that in the fall or the spring? And then my second one was, I heard you talking about cleaning up the garden, and I always wait till after the first frost. Then I clean everything up because I've had a problem with voles and shrews burrowing in my yard, and I don't want to provide habitat for them for the winter. Is there anything else I can do to get rid of them?
Okay, Mark, a couple of different things here to talk about.
Yeah, so for the iris division, the best time they say for that is kind of like late July or August. When things, after they're done flowering. But kind of, to be honest with you, like what I learned at River Falls and what I've learned from my own experience is I kind of just do things when I have the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're better off waiting till next year for that. But, you know, if you do have a lot of them, you could leave the pieces that you want there, you know, in place and then move some if you want to. But the other quick thing about that is that, you know, like, you also, when you divide things, it's nice to let them have time to get reestablished and rerooted into the ground. And now that we're so late in the season and the fact that, you know, it might be cold and then they're not going to be able to get reestablished, it probably would be best to wait till, you know, next year to do it at the right time. That would be my advice. I guess I would say wait since it's so far in the season this year.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the cutback, I mean, that makes a lot of sense of what you're doing. I guess the moles and voles and things, you know, we do have those in our garden. So like I mentioned with the roses, we do put down bait. I don't like to do that because, you know, you also don't want it to like translocate up the food chain, right? And have all your great things that you like your foxes and your hawks and all your other animals then be eating that and it bioaccumulating. So I would, you know, we try to limit that. So I guess you could just keep doing what you're doing, or live with the bit of damage they do. Hopefully it's not significant. So that's what we kind of do in other areas of our garden. The area that they do the most actually tunneling through is our turf grass, I'd say, versus some of our perennial plants and things like that. And if they're just like living in there over the winter, you know, it's not really a big deal to us personally. But I think, you know, you could keep doing what you're doing. Or you could also try an experiment where you leave some stuff up and see what happens, even if they live in it, and, you know, just kind of go from there.
Mm-hmm.
You got any other ideas, Larry?
No, it all sounds good to me. Jan, good luck with that. I'm sorry I missed you in La Crosse, and hopefully we'll be back there again. I'll get to see you. Thank you for calling. Fred and Howard, we'll go to you. Hi, Fred.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I live approximately 2 miles from the botanical garden. And I'm in a very populated area of the village of Howard. And I'm having great difficulty with deer, as your guest speaker spoke to. They're coming in and they're eating everything, especially our beautiful Big Daddy hostas this year. And they're tearing out the bean plants that I have in an above-ground garden. And they were eating the tops off of all of my tomatoes this year. So they're just attacking everything. And the squirrels are going in to our petunia pots because the soil is soft and they just love digging that up. So I don't know what to do anymore.
Well, Scott Craven, a friend of mine who's on the show pretty often, got so tired of it, he finally built an attractive fence around the whole garden to keep the deer out. Of course, that doesn't keep everything else out, but he's eliminated the deer problem with a fence. But what do you do, Mark?
Yeah, that's what I was going to think about too, Larry. You know, like you mentioned, like the deer have, it seemed like, been more prevalent in the last couple of years. So we have had the same issues that you have with them eating our hostas. They've eaten the rose flowers off sometimes. And done a lot more damage than ever before. So one thing we do that helps us kind of is we spray liquid fence. Like we used to just spray it on our bulbs when we plant them, especially tulip bulbs, not daffodils and other ones that are resistant to critters, you know, but we've sprayed it on the ground once we planted our tulips. And then when they come up, we spray them. And we've started to spray our hostas, our roses, and other things we've seen deer eating on. But that, you know, only works for, you know, part of the time. And then eventually they have eaten some of the hostas and things like that. So, you know, exclusion, putting up a fence, it would probably be, unfortunately, like the best solution, but also can be expensive solution. Or, you know, sometimes they, I've been thinking about this for our trial garden where we've had some issues with them eating, is like, you know, putting a sleeve in the ground that we can put a fairly, you know, tall, just like metal post or conduit in, and then getting some of that, like, you know, 8 foot tall kind of black mesh, you know, deer fencing that might be less expensive than having a really, you know, giant, you know, fence put in by a company around some of our areas. So I think we're going to be looking into that option for some of our areas that deer pressure has come into. I think that's about all, you know, you can do is try to exclude them if possible. Yeah. You can try some of the deterrents of the sprays and things like that too, but probably exclusion is like the best answer that'll for sure keep them out.
Yeah, and the sprays you need, you know, after a rain, you need to reapply if you really want to keep after them and such. So, I mean, if you, you know, that's probably is, if you're not going to put a fence up, that's about your next best thing to do, as far as I can tell anyway. Fred, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And I don't know what to do about your pots that the squirrels get in. I am no expert on that because I've got one squirrel that comes and digs only one end of a, you know, about a 4 foot long pot. And it, I quit putting flowers in there because he just knocks them out again right away. So, doesn't bother the ones on the other end for some reason. I don't know why. Oh, man. Thanks, Fred. Randall in northern Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Randall.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I got a question for you. I grow calla lilies, and I've got several different color varieties. And they do nice blooms, nice-looking plants, and they will get a seed pod or a seed head on them. Is there a way that I can grow them from that seed head?
Yeah, I would think you would be able to. You're probably going to want to Google, you know, just like how to do that and what kind of like stratification requirement that seed might need, you know, because I would imagine that is how new cultivars of them are developed, you know, because when you do tissue culture or, you know, propagate things vegetatively, you just get that same plant back all the time. So your seeds would be interesting because you might get some kind of like new cultivar. The only other thing I would say about it is that oftentimes some of those crops that you don't see sold as seed are because it takes a long time for them to say flower from seed. Like, you know, it might take a few years for the plant to size up large enough to, you know, flower for you to be able to see what you have. So I would definitely investigate, you know, growing them from seed and just giving it a shot, but just know that it could take a while for that to actually flower for you to see what you have.
Yeah, that makes sense too. Randall, thank you for calling. Ruth in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. Well, first of all, the hosta guy says spray early and often for deer.
Yeah. And
the rabbits like it too, so make sure that it covers rabbits when you spray. And the squirrels, it's upside down forks in your pot or stones, small stones, and just kind of, you don't have to cover all the dirt, but quite a bit, and that discourages them because they would dig into my pots and my big things in the front, and it stops them from digging up your bulbs, too.
Yeah, all right. Thank you for that tip, Ruth. Appreciate it. I know to keep the cats out of my pots in the house, I use a balled-up aluminum foil. They don't like aluminum foil for some reason. It doesn't have to be even balled up. It just laid in there. I crinkled it a little bit, and they don't like it. So there you go.
Dressing it like having a whole bunch of forks in your pot's probably a pretty good idea. I mean, it's pretty spiky, but it would, if I was a squirrel, I wouldn't want to go in there.
Cindy in Green Bay emailed us. Cindy wants to give a shout out to Mark in the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Her daughter held her wedding there in mid-August, and the gardens were beautiful and a perfect backdrop for the wedding. Cindy noticed so few bugs or diseases, mosquitoes, Japanese beetles, downy mildew. It wasn't there, and wondering what is the secret to your success?
That's a good question. It's just interesting how few mosquitoes there have been out, you know, that in the garden and things like that. And the Japanese beetles, you know, they prefer the irrigated turf grass. So we do have some areas we still, you know, irrigate, but we've definitely taken, like we mentioned with the meadow plantings and things, you know, a lot of irrigated turf grass has changed over to meadow. So that could be part of the reason we don't have as many Japanese beetles is the fact, you know, that we don't really have as much irrigated turf grass, which is where they like to live. I kind of attribute almost everything to just like maybe how we've become more sustainable, leaving all these things up so that we have the beneficial insects that, you know, would go after all those things, the dragonfly larvae and all the other things that would eat the mosquitoes that are in our stormwater detention ponds. And it's like, you know, kind of more of an imbalance ecosystem. You know, we do have our amazing horticulture staff, right, that takes care of all their different areas. And they knock the Japanese beetles into soapy water. They remove any diseased foliage as soon as they see it so that, you know, those aren't there to spread throughout the plantings. They try to, like, you know, add good airflow by, you know, taking seedlings and things out so that there's the, you know, the environmental conditions don't exist for those diseases, you know, to be in place. And it's all just like all the different gardening things that we've learned throughout the years from this show, from all the books, from all of our teaching and education that we try to implement there, and have a great staff that's been there many years and have become great professional gardeners.
Polly emailed us. A friend gifted them a large quantity of dried coneflower heads, which they want to plant in their prairie, thinking of mowing a swath, disturbing the soil, spreading heads, and covering them with a thin layer of topsoil. What are your thoughts on that?
I would say that sounds like a pretty good idea. You know, like a lot of the coneflowers and things will seed out in our garden where we just like sprinkle them over the top of the soil. We've started collecting the seeds from a lot of our native plants, and then we'll, you know, look at Prairie Nursery's website to see the amount of stratification and cold treatment they need, and if it has to be a dry stratification or a wet, and put all that stuff in our refrigerator and, you know, take it out for our production for that pollinator corridor thing. But the, definitely like the low input way would be just to like clear an area, spread it out over there and let it just stratify naturally in our winter climate. So
yeah,
I would just go ahead and do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100% on that. Karen in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know you answered some questions about irises earlier, but I missed it. I just heard the end of it. I have some irises that my brother gave me. He split them in June, and they're in a pot. They're still in this pot. I didn't get them transplanted. Can I keep them over winter in that pot, or I shouldn't plant them now, should I?
Well, that's a good question. what I was looking online, you know, said that really kind of like late summer after flowering is the best time to divide irises. Now, I mean, pretty much when you buy, like have a potted plant that's been established, you know, the whole reason to like a nursery to sell them like that is you can plant them almost any time.
Yeah.
You know, so like if that iris that you have is well rooted in that pot, I would say if you dig a big enough hole, you could go ahead and probably plant it because it does have roots that are in the pot right now that you're just going to, in essence, transplant down into the ground, and they'll still be protected by the surrounding soil. since it is so warm, they'll still have some time to get like established into the surrounding soil. And no matter what you, if you don't do that, you're still going to need to put that plant somewhere where it's going to go through, you know, like the normal cold of the winter time. So another option would be if you have like a vegetable garden, you could just heel that pot into the ground after you harvest everything and then pot it into its spot in the springtime. So it has the whole growing season for its roots to get reestablished in the surrounding soil. Or you could, you know, put it in the kind of like cold-ish but not freezing environment of like your garage or something like that. But that seems like a lot more work that you have to like make sure that it, you know, gets the cold but doesn't freeze the roots, which are the least, you know, cold sensitive part of a plant. So I would either heal that whole pot into like a vegetable garden or somewhere, or just go ahead and if it's well rooted into the pot because you were growing it all summer, I'd just plant it where you want it.
Yeah, I'd do that. I'd plant it where I'd plant it now. I wouldn't. That's the simplest way, too. So there you go, Karen. Thank you so much. You know, we haven't talked at all about your light show, and I certainly don't want to get out of the show without having you talk about that show because it's fantastic. And, okay, it's a little ways away yet, but, you know, people need to plan, too. And November and December are the times.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of funny because you will be planting the bulbs in the ground. And Dave and Sarah, our facilities and manager, and Sarah is one of our horticulturalists, does all our plant records. They'll start setting up the light show with our volunteers next week, actually. So they'll be putting the bulbs above ground and we'll be putting them below ground. And they have about the same amount, 350,000 bulbs in the light show. So it's definitely worth seeing. It's a big, you know, fundraiser for Green Bay Botanical Garden. It supports our mission and helps, you know, fund us throughout the winter months when we don't have as many guests because we are in the state of Wisconsin. But it's what's interesting about it, too, is it's like a botanical themed light show. So it's not really, you know, holiday themed. So you'll see some of the things that you see in your garden just created out of lights, you know, from flowers to water flowing to like, I mean, there's icicles and things that you would see in a winter garden, the icicle forest. And really, there's some interesting things that have changed with the technology of the LED lights and how multicolored they can be and the programmable lights. So this year we're going to have some more interactive features so that you can kind of like be involved more in the light show. And we've had done some of those things over the last couple of years too, the stomp lights in different parts of it in this big tree that changes all these different, you know, patterns and colors, and it can be programmed to change differently every day. So like every night of the light show is different. So definitely check out our website. And, you know, we do have pre-purchase tickets now. That started during the pandemic and it's been successful because it helps, you know, make it a better experience for all of our guests where it's not like a lot of people coming at one time and then other parts of the night not having as many guests. So you do need to get your ticket ahead of time, as you mentioned, Larry, so that you can kind of plan. And there are different, you know, pricing based on how many people there typically are there. There's like value nights for nights when it's not, you know, as many guests typically. And then Friday and Saturday are when usually everybody comes, and then Thursday and Sunday we're also open, but those prices are a little bit different. So you can get all that information on the Botanical Gardens website, gbbg.org, and learn all about the light show and how you can attend it. And we would love to see you out there supporting Green Bay Botanical Garden by visiting us at the Garden of Lights.
It's a fantastic experience and not expensive. And I do like the idea of having a timed, you know, a time when you can go, and then you know that you're going to, there'll be a reasonable number of people there, still be plenty of people there, but it'll be a reasonable number. I noticed you even have wagon tickets.
Yeah, definitely look into the wagon tickets, and if that's something you're interested in, you know, get that soon, because they do sell out, because it is limited by the size of the wagon and the amount of horse, you know, crew that we have, you know, working out there. I guess they're paid in feed. we also have an accessible golf cart, you know, ride tour too, if you can't get onto the wagons because they're sold out, to drive around the trail system as well and see everything. So there's a bunch of opportunities. There's food and beverage there too for sale. And there's the kind of like burn barrel where you wait around for the horses to come and get you. So There's a lot there, and it is a good time, great family activity or great activity for a date or just to bring, you know, your family and have a tradition of coming out there and seeing the lights, which a lot of people do.
Yeah. You do a lot of work with underserved communities as well, Mark, and I think that should be mentioned.
Yeah, we've really been getting into this Museums for All program where you can, you know, come in if you get SNAP benefits, you can get in for a really reduced admission price. And also we have like this access membership where different, you know, community groups can, you know, check out a pass to the garden for people to come and, you know, visit, just kind of like get away, have a mental break from everything and enjoy the beauty of the botanical garden. And, you know, we do work with a lot of, you know, volunteer groups and things to get a chance to come out and, you know, help and be a part of the garden. So we work with Aspiro, who is a group of people with some cognitive disabilities. And what I love about that partnership is, you know, they're full partners in it. They help us plant and take care of the vegetable garden, which is our AAS display garden, where we have like all the vegetable winning seeds and flowers from All America Selections. And then they help take care of it. They help harvest it. And then they actually donate it and bring it over to Paul's Pantry, which is a local food bank here. And then they get a chance to, like, you know, they volunteer at Paul's Pantry too, but they get to give back, you know, to the community through their efforts at Green Bay Botanical Garden. So that's a really partnership that I'm really proud that we've, you know, grown over the years and that we do with Aspiro.
And I don't think we've mentioned at all Carol and Bruce Bell Children's Garden, which is another just really, really cool. What do you got? More than 2 acres, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a 2.5 acre children's garden that just opened last year. So it's This is its second season of being in place. Yeah, so that's been, you know, huge for the botanical gardens. Another, you know, attraction for families to come out and check out. It has a splash play area, raindrop garden, kind of like a mushroom jumper play area with trampolines and slides, and then interpretive signs where you can learn about plants and different ecosystems and nature, a cave play area which celebrates the Niagara Escarpment and Door County area and the plants that kind of grow on that limestone bluff type ecosystem. We have a big lodge that's really cool because it has a wood-burning fireplace and you can rent that out for birthday parties or smaller events and things like that. But, you know, besides our existing children's garden that had the treehouse, rainbow garden, McGregor shed, and we have a Three Sisters, you know, indigenous garden there too. So yeah, it's been amazing. And the other kind of cool thing about it is tying into like what we talked about previously is almost 75% of the plants planted in there are native to the state of Wisconsin. So we were trying to make it a true habitat, you know, kind of echoing the Nature Nurtures Capital campaign that raised the funds for that project, so that not only is it a beautiful garden and a great place for families, it also is a great place for all different animals and critters to live and visit as well.
Mark, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I really appreciate it. Mark Conlock is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And I would go to the website. Just type in Green Bay Botanical Garden, and you're going to get the information about attending the light show and all of the great things they have going on there. He'll be back. We'll talk with him again. Oh, man. Coming up, we're going to take a look at how you can extend your growing season and a look at a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm and how we can extend the gardening growing season. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, it's been a pretty warm fall so far, but the colder weather is certainly coming. And next up, we're going to be talking about extending your growing season despite the colder temperatures with our guest, Sean Kuhn. He is the co-founder of Vitruvian Farms. It's a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm located just outside McFarland. And we'll get his advice on extending the growing season. We'll talk about what he grows on the farm and, of course, take your vegetable questions. So What do you want to know about extending your growing season? Do you have questions about varieties to grow? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Sean Kuhn, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me.
You have a very interesting story about how you got involved in farming, I understand. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, sure. Well, my business partner, Tommy, and I met randomly in college. And just out of curiosity, we started learning about how modern-day food is produced. And essentially, the more we started learning, the more we started becoming concerned about the amount of pesticides and herbicides that are being used, the treatment of farm animals, soil loss that's happening in modern-day agriculture. And so we both kind of veered off our originally intended college, after-college plans, and we decided we just wanted to help be part of the change, and so we decided to start a farm.
And you started an organic farm, which probably didn't just start right from scratch. I mean, you had to do some things to make it a certified organic farm.
Yeah, you have to follow organic principles for at least 3 years before you can become certified, but we essentially started growing with organic practices right from the beginning.
Yeah. What are some problems you encountered going from the idea to being open for business?
I would definitely say just having neither Tommy nor I grew up on family farms. So learning how to grow food was probably the biggest challenge that we've faced. And one of the biggest challenges with growing food is you have to work with Mother Nature. Year to year, you never know what you're going to get. And working with the unexpected, with whatever Mother Nature gives you, is probably the most challenging thing that we've done.
Yeah, Mother Nature, and then the pandemic. I don't know, that must have affected your business model. And
yeah, so
what'd you do to get through that?
When the pandemic started, we got into farming and we started selling wholesale. We sell wholesale vegetables and mushrooms to about 60 different restaurants and groceries in the Madison area, a couple in the Milwaukee area. And at the time when the restaurants were looking to close, about 80% of our sales were wholesale to restaurants. So we had kind of an existential crisis where we were growing all this food and we didn't know how we were going to sell it. And so at that time, we actually came up with a home delivery service. So we launched an online store that still operates today. And you can go to our website and you can buy locally grown food from us and from a ton of other local producers and makers in the Dane County, Wisconsin area. And you can have it delivered straight to your door on Wednesdays and Saturdays every week.
That's amazing. Or just show up at the farm and you can purchase there.
Absolutely. So something we're pretty excited about is we just opened a brand new farm store. We built a building last year and we opened a farm store right on site. And like I said before, with the online store, everything that we sell online, so working with tons of different makers and producers in the Dane County, Wisconsin area, everything from pasture-raised meat, cheese, and dairy and eggs. We sell fruit. We sell pizza from Salvatore's. Ice cream, we sell ready-to-make meals, and of course, vegetables and mushrooms. You can now come straight onto the farm Wednesdays through Sundays, and you can buy it in our store.
Yeah, and it's a broad range of things, and breads, too, I notice. And it's all local, pretty much, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's the focus. It's essentially a small, locally focused grocery store right on the farm.
Yeah, that is really cool. Well, what kinds of – talk about the produce that you grow on the farm.
Yeah, so we grow a pretty wide range of vegetables. We grow a lot of salad greens, a lot of tomatoes, peppers, radishes, turnips, scallions, kind of everything that you'd find that goes into a typical CSA. Salad greens has kind of always been one of our mainstay crops. It's what we started with, and we sell that to a lot of the restaurants. We also grow mushrooms in an indoor growing facility. That's something we started doing more recently. So we're growing shiitake mushrooms, oyster, black king, lion's mane, and maitake mushrooms. Wow. And we have, we're probably growing on about 7 acres, but it's pretty intensive turnover. So we're actually producing a lot of food on those 7 acres. And we have about a third of an acre or so under greenhouse production. So we use those greenhouses in the off season to grow produce year round.
So you're open year round?
We are.
Boy, what are some of the methods you use to extend your growing season?
Yeah, so one of the main things that we use is we use unheated high tunnels or hoop houses. They're kind of like a more simple greenhouse situation. So one of our big focuses has always been energy usage. So in the unheated tunnels, we don't heat the tunnels at all. We just grow cold hardy vegetables, and we're able to grow them in the unheated houses basically November through March, just by selecting the right varieties and then using the right practices. We also have a couple houses where we do add a little bit of heat, crops that are a little bit more tender to the cold, and that just helps us keep a greater variety of crops growing year-round.
So you got protection from the weather. Our light situation isn't as good during those times of the year that you mentioned. Do you need to provide extra light?
In one house, we provide some light. It's where we grow our microgreens. We use light in that house, but in the rest of the houses, it's more about timing the crop growth right, because when you're growing in the fall or spring, crops take longer to reach maturity than they do during the summer. So they could take 3 to 6 weeks longer to grow to harvest time. So we just kind of plan accordingly, and they just take a little bit longer to grow. And by doing that, we don't have to add additional light into the system.
Yeah. Does the taste or the flavor change over time in a situation like that?
Yeah, I would say some crops are better tasting in the winter. A lot of people are familiar with winter carrots. So that would be carrots that have gone through like a frost-free cycle or multiple frost-free cycles. And a lot of crops will actually start producing more sugar because the sugar lowers the freezing point and it helps prevent the cell wall of the plant from bursting during the freezing process. And so the byproduct of that is a sweeter tasting crop. Other things like radishes are like really mild tasting. They don't have as much of the spice. So some people like the flavor of that more. Spinach can also be sweeter during the wintertime. We actually grow a new crop for us as we grow celery. And a lot of people think it's the best tasting celery when you grow it during the winter.
Yeah. And those carrots, man, those carrots are really good.
Yeah, they're something else.
Oh, they are. Jack emailed us. And by the way, you can join in if you have a question for Sean Kuhn. He is co-founder of Vitruvian Farms, and you ought to go online and take a look at the website. It's a dandy website, and you'll learn an awful lot about, well, pretty much everything they're doing there. It's Vitruvian Farms, and Sean Kuhn is the co-founder. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Sean Kuhn, co-founder of Vitruvian Farms, located in McFarland. It's great to have him with us, a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm. Questions? Give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Grant emailed us. Grant says they're regulars at the Monona Farmers Market and always buy your shiitake mushrooms. They are out of this world.
That's awesome.
That's how much work is it to grow? I mean, it's got to be... hard to grow mushrooms in some ways. I mean, and you guys didn't know how to grow mushrooms beforehand. I mean, how'd you learn, and what's the operation like?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's like any other aspect of farming. Farming is not an easy thing to do. Growing mushrooms is completely different than growing vegetables. They have very different needs. The mushrooms that we're growing, they don't use sunlight for energy like plants do. They do use light for directional purposes. So the light kind of signals for the mushrooms on where to grow. We grow all of our mushrooms indoors in specialized fruit chambers. Once the mushrooms are fruiting, that's the part that we're eating. We call it the mushroom fruit. They need anywhere from 80 to 90% relative humidity. So there's constantly mist being added into the rooms to keep that humidity really high, because mushrooms are mostly made of water. And the mushroom operation is a pretty intensive operation for us that runs all week long. The mushrooms can grow, once they're in the chambers, they can grow in 50% larger in one night. Oh. So they grow pretty fast. We kind of got into it just out of curiosity, and it was something that we were growing vegetables, and it was actually a couple years ago when we had torrential downpours in September. We had a really wet fall, a lot of flooding in the Madison area, and that was the first year we were actually hoping to have a really good fall harvest, and Mother Nature kind of came down against that, and we decided we wanted to grow a little bit more crops in a protected way, and since you typically grow mushrooms inside, we started pivoting a little bit more to increase our mushroom production. And the fact that we harvest and we're selling most of those mushrooms the next day, they end up being way fresher than you would normally find.
Yeah. Boy, I would bet so. Jack emailed us relating to mushrooms. Excuse me. He has a hobby farm and interested in growing mushrooms in shipping containers. Can you share your thoughts on that idea?
Sure. Yeah, we actually grow mushrooms in one of our fruit chambers is actually an old shipping container. The one that we're using was a refrigerated shipping container. So it's insulated and the inside is all stainless steel and aluminum. So something I would definitely recommend is looking at getting an insulated one. And then something you have to remember is you're going to be adding a lot of humidity and water into that space. So looking for something like a refrigerated container that already has waterproof walls would definitely be something good to do.
That makes a lot of sense. Renee in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Renee.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a raised garden bed I've been using for about 9 or 10 years, and I'm really intrigued with being able to do some winter gardening. Is there a way to add like a hoop device or structure to a raised bed in order to extend the gardening season for me?
Absolutely. What you could look at getting is either you could get some wire wickets, or you could get PVC or metal electrical conduit. With the metal, you'd have to bend it into the right shape. The PVC, you could just bend it by yourself, and you would stick it into the soil in the raised bed. And then you can either cover that raised bed with a sheet of like greenhouse plastic. It would be best to use greenhouse specific plastic because it's actually treated to not break down with sunlight. Otherwise, it will probably only last like a season or so. Or you can buy what's called row cover. A lot of garden centers will sell this, or you can buy it online at Johnny's Selected Seeds. And that's kind of a thinner material that actually has some breathability to it. If you're growing earlier in the season, you can get away with just that row cover material. And that's actually nice because you don't necessarily have to vent it every day, because it does let some moisture through and it lets air through. But as it starts to get colder, maybe towards late October, early or mid-November, if you wanted to continue growing, you would definitely want a sheet of plastic. And then depending on the temperatures during the day, like right now we're having a very warm fall, you'd want to roll that cover back to let heat out and then roll it back on during nighttime. And then some days where it doesn't get above freezing here and there, like right now we might we might have a day that doesn't give above freezing late October. You would just keep that cover on throughout the entire day. And I would say that could probably get you to last through mid-November, as long as you're choosing cold, hardy vegetables. So you can't necessarily extend the season on everything, because some things are not going to get enough light. But if you're choosing vegetables that are suited for growing during the fall season, things like spinach, lettuce, kale, you could grow turnips, radishes, you could do beets and carrots and things like that. Those things can last without a hoop house with just a simple covering quite long into the season.
Renee, there's some good advice for you. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Bruce in Skokie, Illinois has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was in the Finger Lakes area of New York, in Naples, New York. And, of course, this time of year, it's everything Concord grapes. But I stopped at a little farm thing, and they had onions there. And you asked the people running the register something. It was called candy. And they didn't know anything. You know, the kids running the registers don't know what they're, you know, they can barely tell an apple from an onion. So, but I did talk to the gentlemen that were apparently running it. And they said it was a sweet onion, and then they had a smaller onion, maybe 3 inches in diameter, and then they had a big onion that was about three times the size, and I think he said it was a Murdoch, and he said it was sweeter. Now, I haven't had time to taste the Murdoch, but I just took a slice. I just went out to the car, got an onion out of the bag, and sliced it and ate the slice, and it wasn't sweet. It wasn't like a Maui onion or a Walla Walla or some of the other, sweet onions. A Maui onion, you can eat like a peach or something. It's just, you can taste the onion, but it's sweet. I was just wondering if anybody had heard of a candy onion.
Sean?
I think I have heard of them, but in all honesty, I wouldn't know what the variety would be.
Yeah, so do you grow onions on the farm? I didn't hear onions earlier when you were going through the list, but maybe I didn't hear it.
We have grown onions on the farm. We've done like Walla Walla onions and some storage onions years ago. We don't grow storage onions at this point. We work with some of our partner farms to supply those. One thing we do grow a lot of is green onions. And the green onions are another really good cold hardy crop. Those can actually last through a decent amount of cold.
Yeah, those green onions I've had in my garden, I've had the situation where there was some that I don't know, forgot or whatever, and the next spring they came up.
Absolutely.
And man, are they good.
Yeah, sometimes they can overwinter. If you get a good blanket of snow, they don't even need any protection and they'll start growing again in springtime.
Yeah. Well, Bruce, I haven't heard about the candy onion, and maybe somebody else has, and they could join in and let us know, send us an email or give us a call. We would love to hear more about that. Watering, for these people, anybody who wants to extend their season, is watering much different in the fall, later fall, as opposed to the summertime?
Absolutely. Like I said before, the main consideration is these plants at this time are growing a lot slower, and they're going to slow down as the season progresses. So as the growth slows, the amount of water that they need also slows down. So you're definitely going to be looking to water your plants a lot less frequently than you do during the summertime. And another big thing to consider is it's a really good idea to try to keep the leaves of your plants as dry as possible going into fall, because one of the things that happens with wet leaves and the cold is you can have a lot of fungal diseases attack the leaves of your plants. So you could get things like downy mildew or bacterial spots. So what I would recommend to anyone trying to extend their season is either to use some sort of drip irrigation, or if you're using a wand, try to water the soil and not the leaves, so that the leaves go into the night and they're nice and dry. And if possible, some falls we have a lot of excessive rainfall. Something that they can really benefit from is being covered, like I said earlier, with like a sheet of plastic or something like that. Essentially, the drier you keep your leaves, the greater the chance you're not going to see any fungal issues.
Luke in La Crosse emailed us, this back to mushrooms again. Luke's best understanding of how mushrooms grow was through watching a few episodes of Clarkson Farm in England with Jeremy Clarkson when he was growing mushrooms. It showed how fast the mushrooms grow, as well as the fragility of the growing environment, and very interesting. And here you are growing, what, shiitake, you've got oyster, you've got lion's mane. Is there anything else?
Yeah, we're growing maitake, and we're also growing black kings as well.
So do those, are they all kind of the same when it comes to the growing conditions, or do you have, and light and or lack of and everything else? Can they be?
Yeah,
go ahead.
These are all wood-eating mushrooms, so these are primary decomposers. So they're taking red oak sawdust mixed with either soy hulls or wheat mids, and they're breaking that down. So that material hasn't been composted. Versus like a button mushroom is actually a secondary decomposer. So that's actually eating compost, some materials that have already been broken down one time, and then they're further breaking it down. Our mushrooms are primary decomposers. So they're all growing on a very similar substrate, and we grow them in very similar temperature conditions. They do have pretty specific conditions that they like to fruit in. And outside of those conditions, you'll start to see issues with bacteria or mold, or they simply won't fruit. So we have to basically maintain a temperature range. Most of them like it a little bit cooler, so it's growing in about 55 to 65 degrees Fahrenheit. And they have slightly, one to the next, they have slightly different humidity requirements. So some of our rooms are a little bit more humid than the other ones, but they're all relatively similar.
So, and you're obviously doing very well with the mushroom, well, with all of it. And this has required a lot of cooperation. And kind of took the bull by the horns, I guess, in getting involved with other farmers and other sources for your farm.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the grocery store that we just opened on the farm, working with all the different producers and makers and farmers in the state of Wisconsin, that all kind of grew out of the COVID epidemic when we started our online store and our home delivery service. And we just thought it was a good opportunity to partner with other farmers in the community and help each other support each other, essentially.
Well, it's been great, and obviously you've been successful even under some pretty terrible pandemic-like conditions.
We've been very lucky.
Well, lucky and hard work and a lot of education and learning on your part, and then passing it along to others. Sean, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I love your website. What's the address? I just typed in Vitruvian Farms and it came up.
Absolutely. You can find us at vitruvianfarms.com. And then you can also find us on Facebook, where we put updates about things that are happening on the farm. Our farm store, which is located just outside of McFarland, is open Wednesdays through Sundays. Most days it's 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. On Sunday we go to 3. And you can also check out our website for ordering online. And you can get food from us and from other farmers and makers delivered right to your door on Wednesdays and Saturdays.
Sean Kuhn, co-founder of Vitruvian Farms, our guest today. And quick thanks to everybody who helps make the show possible. Clara Neipert and Joel Padnott, our producers, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.